Hello and welcome to episode 238 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and David Carroll.
Well, welcome back everybody to the latest episode of WB40. This week we're joined by David Carroll and we're going to talk about a little bit about ad tech and the rather strange goings on in the courts around how it uses or misuses privacy data. But Matt, we're going to start off by asking you the same old question. How was your week?
It's weird, isn't it? We're kind of in this weird liminal state at the moment. We're in this liminal state between a moment of national grief, an outpouring of things that outpour, and an increasing sense of dread that the politics that we've had for the last 9 years that have been really strange are about to get a whole lot stranger. And that in the last 2 weeks we've had a Prime Minister announce that they're going to plough £150 billion into the economy, and there's been no conversation about it whatsoever because other events have happened. And so I'm feeling somewhat weirded out. At a much more prosaic level, I'm feeling really quite like the next few years are going to be a struggle because we've now got two children in senior school, and whilst one of them is a delight and with a joyous expectation will open his books to be able to do his homework, younger one ain't like that. And it's, 3 hours of very patient battle to be able to get the homework done this week. At some point we'll just have to go, nope, if you don't do it, that's fine. The teachers will punish you. So it's been an interesting week.
Good. Well, David, welcome to WB40. How's your week been? Because you're in New York, I think, and that's so. You haven't had quite as much of the week as we have yet. You're still a few hours behind. How's it been for you?
Well, it's certainly has been top of the news here in the United States too. So a global spectacle of epic proportions, no matter where you are, and so it is remarkable to see the precision of it all. I guess that's something that I wonder how the national spirit, to be precise, is mobilized in an incredible way. I don't think Americans could ever do that. But so that's been interesting. And I guess just watching from afar, Boris Johnson came so close to presiding over this moment. You'd think that this would have been what it was all leading up to, but no, he missed his chance. So I really don't know what to make of it, though. It's very remarkable and of course certainly historic.
And how about your work? What's been going on this week? Anything interesting?
Well, I have been starting my academic year the past few weeks, and one of the things that we look at in the class is we meet once a week, and each week I'm able to say, something extraordinary in the world of data privacy and tech controversies, et cetera, will happen when we meet next week. And it's been pretty consistent now for the few years I've been teaching. So when I, put forth that the previous week, I'd never suspected that the Queen would be dead the following week. But, you have to keep track of all the current events.
As an academic, is that something you relish with the kind of, not the dying of monarchs, but the, maybe you do, I don't know, but the kind of constantly big changing events in your field, which means that your field of reference or what you're doing presumably is therefore continuing to change. Is that a great thing, or is that a bit of a pain from a managing curriculum?
It's both. It's exhilarating and exhausting. It means I have to teach the class in both a linear and a non-linear way. Meaning, the events of the world do not wait for the curriculum. They just happen. And I feel it's important to tune my students into paying attention to them because they're always happening, and they're happening in sort of incredible velocity. And sort of to notice that is an important skill. But then we also have to teach a linear, logical, rational, sort of try to make sense of it all and to put it back in order and to put it back into a context of concepts and comparisons and structure. So we have to do both. We can't make the curriculum wait for the events, nor the events wait for the curriculum. So we have to do both. I think the students appreciate realizing that it's a dynamic field, and it's one that's in the process of being debated and shaped and formed. So it is not like other subjects, which perhaps, you know, are well defined and you're really perhaps studying the history, the impact of them. This is more about, you know, I guess, you know, it is, I guess, relevant to the passing of a monarchy in the sense that it is the end of an era and the start of a new one. And so therefore, you know, there's a much change occurring. And so to be alive during it and to be being able to carefully observe it while also struggling to, you know, keep your eyes on the big picture and see the forest from the trees, et cetera, is a big challenge. But I do enjoy the ability to do that, but it is a challenge to keep making sense of it and for lots of different kinds of students.
Interesting. Chris, how has your week been?
Well, it's been quite an interesting week, really, given, you know, work continues and lots of, you know, got lots of good stuff going on at GMAR. I've got, you know, kids back at school. Everything seems to be falling into place. And then last week I had a bit of a cold and I felt a bit sorry for myself. I think it's the first cold I had for 3 years because, of course, we've all been far too careful of passing around illnesses to get colds. But, yeah, the return of having a cold, but which I remember as being a minor thing, I was moping about like a bear with a sore head for many days, I have to tell you. So I'm quite glad that's over. But, yeah, I mean, really, of course, the you know, what's going on in the world, what's going on with since the 8th of September when the Queen passed away and the kind of interesting change in dynamics, really, because there's been a lot of conversation about what would happen when the Queen died and what would happen to the monarchy and what would happen, you know, to this, that and the other. And actually, not much of that has seemed to take place so far. I think there's been a kind of sense of, well, you know, that's the end of an era and we'll see what happens next. But yeah, it's been, I guess, one for watching and taking in, really, and reflecting on it. It takes some time to do that. But yeah, it's been a decent week overall.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing I heard on one of the many broadcasts over the last few days. They're talking about how this marks the end of the post-war era.
Mm. Mm.
Which is, I think, a really interesting analysis, because actually so much of what we talk about in the UK still seems to be grounded in a conflict that took place a very long time ago and is such a core part of the, well, certainly the English psyche. And, yeah, it's going to be a funny few years, I think, if, you know, we survive economic and environmental Armageddon. So, you know, it's all good.
This is fine.
You know, I know. It's nothing like watching funerals all day to be in a great, happy state of mind. Yeah. There we go. Anyway, let's crack on with this week's show. It's going to be a good dive into the worlds of both ad tech and data privacy. So let's crack on.
So as we said before, we're going to talk about data privacy and the ad tech industry, really. It's an industry that has had a fairly checkered existence, leaning as it does on a lot of behavioural advertising and nudging and various methods by which it purports to be able to get us to do things that maybe we wouldn't have otherwise done. And the amount of data that it needs to gather in order to perform these magic tricks seems to increase all the time. And of course, we've seen GDPR in the UK and various similar types of legislation around the world as people and governments try to find ways to protect their citizens from being exploited in this way. And our guest, David, he's famously one of the people who has, one of the very few people who's been able to get the Information Commissioner's Office to do anything at all, which is a great effort. I probably wouldn't be able to do that now because I think the ICO is even smaller than it was then and even less well-funded. And you can see the results of that in The Great Hack on Netflix. But David, you've been watching this latest contretemps in the courts with interest, I gather, because, you know, with your previous experience and some of the people that you know involved in that in this work, the ad tech industry isn't doing itself any favors, right?
No, it's not. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me. And it's funny to think that it took an American citizen to get the UK Information Commissioner's Office to make a bold action. I guess you're referring to their criminal prosecution of Cambridge Analytica while it was in administration, the only thing that the courts would allow any regulator to do against the company while it was shrouded by the moratorium that companies enjoy once they go into administration or in the U.S. declare bankruptcy. So it was, you know, I guess it was remarkable that anything happened in that regard. But interestingly so, we ultimately relied on Channel 4 to deliver the goods, meaning the ICO never really gave me my full data set. It was a leak to the press and then the press showing up at my door and finally delivering what I had been after the whole time. It was indeed proof that, you know, every American voter was profiled in the UK by a British company, and every registered voter in the 2016 election had a personality profile created about them. And this was regardless of whether their Facebook data was pilfered by a developer, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and even though the ICO declared that this was in violation of the basis of data protection law, that was the best that they could do, was slap them on the hand for ignoring the order to give me all my data, and Channel 4 had to do it in the end. So we still rely on the press to get the answers. And it was, you know, out of that controversy and I guess success that my solicitor Ravi Nayak took on new clients and expanded his data protection practice. He started a new firm that's been specializing in really advancing the state of affairs in this realm. And he took on a client to really take on the ad tech industry and strike at the heart of the behavioral advertising business model and to challenge the industry's assertion that it has figured out how to be compliant with European data protection. And obviously there's reason to be skeptical of that, and it was not that difficult to put a convincing case together. And then I've been watching Ravi Nayak take this case through. His main client is someone I also know, Dr. Johnny Ryan, who I first met many years ago, back in like 2014, during the sort of ad blocking panic, the moral panic back then. It's hard to remember, but almost a decade ago, there was a moral panic about people installing ad blockers, and were you stealing from publishers? What was it morally right to block ads? What we, of course, see most people were just trying to protect their privacy. But Johnny Ryan was right there because he was working for a company called PageFair, which was studying the popularity of ad blocking, and so he's always been examining the sort of inherent flaws of this business model. And so currently he's at the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, and it's very important that he's based in Ireland. It's very important that, you know, I guess he's Irish, because ground zero in Europe for the tech industry is Dublin, because all the companies are headquartered there because the tax benefits are suitable for such things. So it puts a lot of regulatory gravity in Ireland. So it's good we have Johnny there. And it's good that we've got somebody who's been following this industry for a long time. And it's good that he and Ravi are working together, because their case, you know, has gone through, you know, in and out of the Information Commissioner's office now between two commissioners, and has worked its way, you know, through the process, and more recently is finding itself in the High Court in Europe. And the remarkable thing is that this case has not been knocked down. It's making its way through the process, which I would hope, you know, is making the trade group that has created the mechanism, which is supposed to be okay, quite nervous, because it doesn't seem like they're going to make it through this process without having to substantially rethink how they do business. So it's exciting in the sense that we're seeing people use the data protection law for what it was intended and holding the companies to account. And this is the process by which it's done. It's slow but fast at the same time. And the specifics of it we could get into, but it's an important moment where sort of self-regulation mindset is clashing head-on with the mindset of Brussels, where regulation is an important, you know, process to invest in, to hold companies to account. So We're seeing it play out, and the results of which will be significant in terms of charting the course of the future. There are some parallel, you know, cases in the U.S. which also show, you know, how some of the fundamentals of the business are being challenged.
So, just to, for people who aren't aware of the detail within this, at a high level, the internet advertising industry, through a body called the IAB, have got a kind of code of practice for how they expect their members, so advertising providers, to operate. And so essentially are saying, trust us, it's all okay. And the challenge that's being taken in the court is basically is to say that that code of conduct isn't compliant with core European legislation around data privacy, in particular
yep.
GDPR.
It is a sort of self-regulation protocol or standard that companies can voluntarily participate in, called Transparency and Consent Framework, or TCF. And it tries to mechanize the idea that when you go to a site or a service and you say you accept, or you know, by using the service, you're under the terms, that therefore the consent that you're giving to one service extends to sort of an unlimited number of third parties that are also processing and transferring and participating in the data supply chain, that they all get consent too, even though you have no relationship with them. And so there's a sort of fundamental problem of, like, how can anybody really exercise true consent with this kind of mechanism, which is really just upholding the status quo? And then the other really shocking thing that Johnny and other researchers discovered when they scrutinized the framework was that it really organizes the targeting of people in very specific ways into very sort of delineated categories. And many of the categories people, or ordinary people, would find just really shocking and uncomfortable and invasive, but advertisers use these categories, you know, without blinking an eye. So categories that are very sensitive, related to health issues, mental health issues, substance abuse, gambling addictions, even being victims of sexual crimes and incest, child abuse, a whole litany of sort of categories by which people can be targeted for related services. The ad industry really has the mindset that everyone should be targeted for anything, including really sensitive things, because the idea is that then they can be helped. We can match the person who's suffering from abuse with an advertiser who advertises therapies. So they have a mindset that they think this is legitimate. And the question is, do the courts agree once it's held up to the standards, you know, of a regime which puts personal dignity ahead of most of the rest of the industry? That is, your own personal dignity as expressed through data protection comes first. And so this idea that there's a high-speed trading market for vectors such as rape and incest victims is really problematic. Or do we know that the gambling addiction targeting vector is being abused or not? Certainly that would be a great targeting category that could be abused. Rather than target for gambling support services, you could be targeted for making bets. So it's just, when you lift the hood or the bonnet on this mechanism and this machine, no one likes what they see except for the marketers. So it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, what the judges and the various appeals and so on, what they all think about this, because it really lays it out. Like, is this a legitimate way that targeting should be conducted? And how is it possibly legal given the basic ideas of data protection?
Interesting. Something that I saw today, it was a thread on Twitter about from somebody who essentially, since their mother died not very long ago, had been contacted by six different mediums offering to, you know, help them get in contact with the deceased. And yeah, that's something that's happened for a long time, right? People will prey on others at the moment of their when they're most vulnerable. And of course, now we've got the ability to do that on an industrial scale. I guess the question is it really that new? And is it the scale that's the problem, or is it the ethical issue?
Sure. So, I mean, there's nothing new about advertisers wanting to save money on their ad spend. And this is a perennial problem that has always existed for as long as there's been a publicity of any sort. Is advertisers know it works, but they don't know how it works precisely. And so there are many ways to make advertisers feel better about their spending. And the promise of digital was that it was going to eliminate the waste somehow by showing advertisers that every pound spent translated into a return somehow. And an elaborate system was erected to try and create that feeling. And so I think when we realize that the whole system is not necessarily scientifically accurate, it doesn't have to be. It only has to convince advertisers that it's worth spending the money on. So we know that it works, but we don't know exactly how and why. And it doesn't know either. And this is not only because of the kind of business model of advertising, that it doesn't have to be peer-reviewed and scientifically proven. It just has to be economically viable. Is the way that then machine learning, machines, networks, massive amounts of data sets, large models, really all the things related to the rapid advancements of computer science, you know, in the past 10 years, and what we're really concerned about now is that now so much data is fed into these really complicated algorithms and machine learning models, and they can make very accurate predictions, but we don't know how they work. Now, we really don't know how they work. The companies don't know how they work. Facebook has no idea how Facebook works. Facebook has no idea where your data goes once it goes into Facebook. They know that it works. They don't know how. And the advertising brain, the digital ad brain, you know, is an alien brain. It thinks in n dimensions necessary to target ads, whereas the feeble human brain only thinks in four dimensions at most. And so it's figuring out ways to do ad targeting that we can't even understand. We have not built the tools to understand it or the translation to understand it. And we know that it works because when Apple released an update to iOS and deployed what's called ad targeting transparency. So we have two acronyms here today. We have ATT and TCF. TCF is the invisible ad tech suppliers business model in industry standard for controlling privacy. And then Apple comes out with ATT, which puts the choice right in front of iPhone users. And all of a sudden, one day people update their iPhone and then it says, do you want this app to allow you to track? And then you say, ask app not to track or allow track. And unsurprisingly, it's the first time that many digital users, people, had been offered an honest choice up front. And of course, single digits of percentage said yes. And then this sent a shockwave through the digital advertising marketplace. And we saw Facebook stock fall and other related companies like Snapchat, Shopify. The sort of digital economy took the hit because indeed all of our apps were snitching on us, sending our data to Facebook and Google, making their ads so incredibly effective, meaning advertisers were really happy to spend their advertising dollars on Facebook. And then once that flow of data from our devices into the mothership was cut off by Apple, it realigned the space significantly. And we got a clearer sense of just how effective the ads are. And we saw it because the stock prices fell.
This is a fascinating conversation because I think up until this, my view around internet advertising generally has been a combination of, I don't think it's nearly as effective as the likes of Cambridge Analytica would make it out to be, that my data in aggregate with others will probably lend it to have more value to me than it would ever have to me selling my data. So the value exchange there I've always kind of been happy with. But the thing that I think is ringing alarm bells in my head for the first time now is, but I'm in a fortunate position to not have any particular vulnerabilities. I'm wealthy, I'm male, I'm white, I'm straight, I'm middle class, I'm middle-aged, I own a home. You know, this kind of across the board. If I get heavily targeted for nice wine, I'm good, but I've got the ability to be able to fight that. But when you talk about things like gambling or, you know, grief after significant life events or trauma after significant life events, and the idea, therefore, of machine learning to be able to gather and analyze and bring together to target on the basis of things that nobody understands why. And I think particularly, I don't know, the UK, this has been a bugbear of mine for quite some time now. We have a massive gambling problem in the UK. It's huge. We have, I can't remember the number, something like 500,000 people clinically addicted, hundreds of thousands of children having treatment for gambling addiction, that we have most of our sports, unless you're a massive, massive soccer team like Manchester United and you have a global brand, everybody else has got advertising for betting on there. And the idea that therefore the targeting of ads to somebody who could be just made to just take that bet now.
Yep. The sports gambling has been deregulated in the US recently. So we're seeing new states, and this is a, so actually we're moving towards the UK in terms of creating more opportunities to gamble digitally, especially related to sports. It's huge now. It's a new thing. And there's, and we have absolutely no baseline protections. At least there is some basic data protection rights left in the UK after Brexit, that people who are being abused through their gambling addiction, you know, have some recourse to. I worry about what's going to happen here now.
You mentioned Brexit there, and I'm interested as to what's changed since you made that original case, because part of when I was reading the stuff about the current case is about potentially using the UK as a bit of a bridge between the EU and the US, which to me seems, I don't know, it does seem illogical, in as much as if the UK wants data adequacy with the EU, it has to have a watertight way of dealing with data. And maybe I'm getting it wrong, but do you see this as a tactic potentially from the advertisers to try to use a slightly watered down but still adequate UK data regime as a way into Europe? Is that an idea that seems to make sense? But I have to say, I'm a little bit in the dark. I don't understand how that could be, but I've seen enough. There's been enough ambiguity in the way these things have dealt with in the last few years to make me think it could actually happen.
Sure. So, I mean, I'll answer the question or respond to the question, you know, in the sense of being struck myself with the far-reaching impact of Max Schrems and his activism and legal cases, which have struck down not one but two treaties between Europe and the United States, first the Safe Harbor and then Privacy Shield. And one of the things that President Joe Biden has been trying to do is to reestablish a data treaty to recover the basis for free flow of trade. So that's going on in the context of the UK asserting a reform of its own, kind of trying to assert some data regime independence for its own sake, maybe, at the same time. And then also what's going on in the US is the US is flirting with passing data protection laws and privacy laws in new ways that were unthinkable, certainly before Cambridge Analytica. And the other element that's unique in the US that's playing out, that is, you know, it turned out that even the Supreme Court here may not have privacy, because the draft of a opinion leaked, which foretold the fall of the Roe versus Wade decision, which revoked a woman's right to choose regarding abortion and reproductive health. And then that has created a political firestorm across the country here and has created a condition which has really made a kind of worst case scenario that private activists and ballots even like would have, when they're thinking about like worst case scenarios that could possibly come true, we have one now. So the state of Texas passed a law which deputizes the enforcement of its anti-abortion law to ordinary citizens to then get a bounty of $10,000 to bring evidence to prosecute people for providing assistance in any way to people seeking abortions. So it creates a vigilante system and even a bounty hunter system. Like the law induces this. And so now there's great concern with how data privacy relates to this new legal condition, which creates great hostility and animosity and even a regressive relationships between states. Whereas can somebody looking to collect a $10,000 bounty use the data broker and ad tech to achieve their targets? And the answer is absolutely, because data brokers routinely sell device identifiers of people visiting abortion clinics and family planning centers and reproductive health centers. Like that's actually a thing that is sold by data brokers. So going back to the IAB's TCF, what's being litigated in the high courts is this idea that the industry enumerates what it sells, which are these target groups. And we don't know we've been enumerated this way. We don't know we're sold this way. So what you can do is you can buy device identifiers of people who are visiting sensitive locations, and then you can buy other data sets and then match it to personal identifiable information. So you can take device IDs and put it with the people who own those devices, and then you're able to track people and their life activities, which have become, you know, highly sensitized based on, you know, a greater, more fundamental question of, in the United States, is privacy a function of your personal autonomy to be deciding your own reproductive destiny? And does the state control that? And how, you know, so sort of like the most fundamental idea of privacy is being reconsidered or is at stake in the United States. And so I think people are, you know, we went from thinking privacy is a big deal, actually, out of the 2016 election. So we watched Brexit happen, and then we watched Trump happen. And we're like, maybe this is this digital technology. Maybe privacy does matter. Then COVID came around, and it also, you know, revealed people's privacy anxieties related to the pandemic. And the political anxieties and the turmoil related to that, and everything was politicized. And then Roe v. Wade fell, and the right to abortion as a federal right disappeared. And so this fact that we don't have privacy enumerated, and we have this Wild West industry where you can buy things like who goes to abortion clinics, it's just that's for sale. Like, that's just for sale here. Like, how do we recover from that? So I think in the context of your question, like, the U.S. is in the process of a major realignment. It came really close to passing a federal privacy law this Congress. It could next Congress. And then it's moving, in that case, it's moving towards Europe. It's moving towards Brussels. And so where is Westminster going to be when it might think that the U.S. is... you know, I just it's going to be a difficult calculus to predict where two moving targets are going, or actually three, because we see where Brussels moving and it's sort of like zeroing in on how to hold these companies accountable, and we have the U.S. like going through a gut wrenching process, no pun intended, and then the U.K. is trying to change too, and so, you know, how can it predict where we're going to be when we're in the process of changing?
Yeah, it's a really, I mean, that's a kind of horrifying example that you've given. You know, you think about Eastern Europe or West or East Germany before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and if these things were available then, it would have been, you know, it would have been a pretty awful place to be. And essentially, that's what you're talking about, is people making an industry out of telling tales on each other in order to get favour with the establishment. But And which makes the requirement, the need for government to to stand up and say, actually, we need to protect people's rights. Absolutely vital. But there are two sides to that, aren't they? Because government, whilst they do, they really should be doing that, they always really deep down would like to know more about what was going on and will try to gather more information, like the Online Harms Bill, which is, I think it's called, which in the UK, which is seeks to make every single website know exactly who's using their site, for example, and the age of that, and the potential issues around that. It seems to be pushing in the other direction. So they're tricky waters, really, aren't they, to navigate between gathering more information and gathering less information, and when you do gather the information, treating it responsibly.
Yes, and interestingly, a similar bill to that just passed in California. So the age-appropriate design code. This is an example where the UK has been very influential on legislation at the state level. California is the laboratory of regulation. It sort of weirdly, Sacramento has really weirdly become the Brussels of the USA. And sure enough, there's this new code which was influenced directly by what's been going on. And it is very similar in the sense where there is a political will and appetite in the U.S. to regulate tech to protect the children. Like the Republicans and the Democrats will hold hands and sing with roses when it comes to protecting the children. So that gets done, and that got done in California on top of, you know, the strongest data protection law at the state level here, the California Consumer Privacy Act. And so this has a similar thing where they acknowledge they were inspired by what's been done similarly in the UK. And it's the idea of, if you make web and app operators, you know, where it becomes like safer for them to make the privacy by default not abusive, but protecting of people, that will reform the system in lieu of something else. You know, I hate to say it, but like the children are being used as a pawn in the game here, that they're basically saying, sure, you could set up all these things and ruin the internet, but you wouldn't do that now, would you? You would just stop behaving so badly. You would just set your defaults to something that is age appropriate, that is more ethical, you know, I personally don't like these ulterior motive legislative tricks. I don't like the idea that we have to then like do things with loopholes and arbitrage. Like it would be better for everyone to have equal rights, equal protection, and like not just do things for based on your age. So I think it's a bad kind of way to get results where there's so much obstruction to get results the more sensible way. But I think that's what's happening here is there's so much pressure to do something. The thing that needs to be done, they don't have the will, so they can do this. And it's going to have unintended consequences, sure.
I'd be more convinced that the government was, or governments were interested in protecting children if they would do something about the many, many offline harms that exist before they started thinking about online harms, frankly. We seem to be quite happy to let them go hungry, but heaven forfend that they see a penis on a website. So it's, yeah, some of the priorities seem a little bit weird sometimes.
Is there much variation in different states in the US around this? Because obviously with the outcome of Roe versus Wade, that's been interpreted in very different ways across different states. Is it a similar sort of state of affairs with issues around improving or, you know, removing privacy laws?
So since Cambridge Analytica, the scandal of 2018, we've had four states pass privacy laws at the state level. California was first, and it was led really by a ballot initiative, which is a unique feature to California, and it really pressured the lawmakers in the Capitol to do the unthinkable. And so, yeah, it was remarkable that the home of Silicon Valley became the place where the strongest law was passed, and this was a unique feature of California. It couldn't have happened in any other state. That then created a cascade, like a slight cascade, in the sense that then a more industry-friendly law was passed in Virginia, and then an even more industry-friendly law passed in Utah, And then a stronger but still not as strong as California law was passed in the state of Connecticut, so in the Northeast in New England. And so we have seen some activity. And then simultaneous to that, a flurry of tech bills, you know, got a lot of activity in this Congress, but nothing, you know, went across the president's desk to sign, which is, you know, unfortunate given all the energy. We got to rein these companies in. Let's do it. And then and it hasn't really happened, but they came close. A bill came out of committee called the American Data Protection and Privacy Act, or you can call it affectionately ADPA. It's sort of the GDPR for the U.S. And it passed out of committee, which is, means it got out of Republican and Democrat opposition. And then we don't expect it to be brought forth to be put up for a vote at the full Congress, primarily because California doesn't want to be preempted. It doesn't want its powerful state law to be preempted by this federal one. So we have this now power struggle between California and the rest of the country, California being, you know, a powerful state by economic and political might. And there are other precedents for California laws being the standard, even like the hemispherical standard. I mean, arguably California emissions laws are set the standard for the Western Hemisphere. So they have a reason to be sort of to have this exceptionalism. They really do think that their data privacy law could be the law of the land. So they don't want to give it up. So that struggle, that tension is playing out now. It's very, you know, uniquely American problem is that the state's rights versus the national standard is playing out. So that's at the specific sort of tech regulation, tech policy level. That's against the backdrop of the fall of abortion rights and some states passing laws to protect people from other states. So like creating sort of safe haven states where you can go here for an abortion and we won't let another state extradite you. So like the fact that the states are being pitted against each other, almost like hostile nations that don't have extradition treaties, does not bode well for the unity necessary to keep the dream alive.
I mean, if I look at the impact of GDPR within my remit of running technology within organizations and being involved in consulting to organizations, I think that it's become often a way of people saying, no, we can't do that, just as a kind of bureaucratic excuse in the way that you can use regulation in an organization. So no, we're just not going to do that. So people become very, very, organizations that aren't exploiting data become very afraid of it all. And then it becomes almost a reason to not get good at managing data because it's all too complicated. And then we've got tech companies who just kind of seem to be either blatantly ignoring it or skirting on a, you know, on a knife edge of what is acceptable or what is not. I do wonder, for certainly the big players in the tech scene at the moment, could they survive without these sorts of ways about being able to monetize their services? So are they constantly just going to be looking for the loopholes?
Yeah. I mean, it seems funny that people can be so scared of regulation and regulators when what is the evidence that they are so fearsome? Like, what are the penalties that you're so afraid of? I mean, it's really hard. There's so much deference built into businesses and organizations that to get in trouble, you really have to be really, really bad. And Cambridge Analytica wasn't bad enough to get the full force of the international regime to that I would allege that they used insolvency and liquidation and bankruptcy to get out of it. And then Facebook spent $5 billion on a fine to avoid having to do a deposition to answer questions about it. And then more recently, just, you know, this past week or two in California, the class action lawsuit is settling regarding the Cambridge Analytica fiasco, and they're happy to settle that. No matter, there's money is no object. Any amount of money will be spent to avoid having to tell the whole truth about Cambridge Analytica. So if the baddest of baddies don't get in trouble, Like, what are ordinary organizations really worried about? It's a strange paranoia when you really sit and think about it. And then, indeed, many of the rules, you know, provide so much opportunity for companies to fix the mistakes that people point out. Like, they're called curing periods, where if, like, somebody says, you know, you're abusing my data, then they get time. Oh, we'll fix that. And if they fix it, then you can't get them in trouble. So interestingly, the California Attorney General issued its first decision against a company enforcing the California Consumer Privacy Act. And hilariously, it was not an American company. It was a French company. Sephora, the makeup retail giant, was the first company to be fined under the California law. And the California law has this curing period where they're like, they tell you, if you fix this and this and this, then you're fine. And they did it. They ignored it. No, we're not going to fix it. And so then they got the fine. The fine because they refused to... So, I mean, businesses and organizations, the deference built into them is unbelievable. And they only get penalized when they fail to take advantage of their own built-in deferences.
That was a fascinating conversation. David, thank you for joining us on the show this week. It's very much appreciated. What have you got coming up in your world in the week ahead?
Well, thanks for having me. Great to talk about all these things, a kind of spiraling discussion. I am, you know, continuing to think and talk about these things. In fact, getting ready to go to Brown University in Providence, where I'll be reunited actually with Paul-Olivier Dehaye, who is also seen in The Great Hack on Netflix. He was the data protection researcher who recruited and convinced me to do the original data request. So he's doing workshops at Brown University, and I'm going to be going there to do a talk with him. I think that'll be live streamed, so keep getting ready for that.
Brilliant. And Chris, how's your week ahead looking?
It's pretty busy, actually, partly because it's been compressed into 4 days rather than five, and because I didn't do any proper work today, I'm afraid. I was entirely lazy and didn't do any real work. I've got to go to, I think I'm in London on Thursday, so I'm going to go down to London on Thursday. Oh, and of course, so I'm going down for a meeting, and then in the evening I'm going to the CIO 100 evening, which is this Thursday, which is good, because it's always good to see people down there and to catch up with a few old friends and meet some new people. So that's good. But I've got so much to do, Matt. I've got like webinars to do and presentations to do that I've kind of agreed to and looking forward to. But they all seem to be in the next few weeks, including a trip to Cyprus to go talk about digital transformation, Digital Cyprus conference. And yeah, it's all great, but it's all got to be prepared for. And at the moment, I haven't done very much of it. So that's my week.
We're deep into conference season now, aren't we?
This is
September, yeah. October.
This is happening.
Maybe a bit into November, and then it's Christmas. So, yes. Actually, it makes me think this is the first CIO 100 that I've not been involved in any way as either a participant or a judge since about 2017. So say hello to
me. Well, I'll pass on your regards. I'm sure everybody will remember you.
Maybe, you know, who knows. I have mostly got to be able to do another proposal for a client this week. That's my main task, and bringing together a couple of teams for some pieces of work that we're doing. And I think it's the very last of my network of friends' 50th birthday celebrations this coming Friday. So we've managed to make it through the best part of a year and a half of celebrating various people's 50s, and this is the last one, which means that we've just got to look forward to people turning 60 next, which is so depressing, but it's a few years away yet. So David, thank you for joining us. Chris, a pleasure as ever. Dear listener, it's wonderful to have you. Hopefully you found that enlightening and fascinating. Next week we are going to be joined by Perry Timms, who is an incredible thinker in the world of HR and people. And no, that isn't what you think it is. It's so much better. So we're looking forward to having Perry on the show next week. Until then, see you next week.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com or on Twitter @WB40 Podcast and on all good podcasting platforms.